Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and today we're going to be discussing a subject that all of us have been involved with on one level or another. It's the subject of philanthropy. But we're going to be talking about how money can be well spent. In fact, it's the title of the book we're going to be discussing today, Money Well Spent, A Strategic Plan for Smart Philanthropy. My guest is Mr. Paul Brest. He is the president of the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. Mr. Brest, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Donna.
You are a man of phenomenal accomplishment, I think. You have obviously been very deeply involved with the world of business, but being the president of the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, this came about after you had been a professor at Stanford Law School, and you served as a dean from 1987 to 1999. You taught courses on judgment and decision-making in the public policy program at Stanford University. And you've got another book that you're coming out with, which sounds absolutely wonderful, about problem-solving. And your associate author, Hal Harvey, was the former director of the Hewlett Foundation's Environment Program and now is the president of Climate Works Foundation. And he is the president of the Newland Foundation, and he himself has held positions at several different not-for-profit foundations, including the Mertz Gilmore Foundation, the Heinz Endowments, and the Plowshares Fund. My gracious, you men have, as a team, have put together an absolutely an informative book, but the depth of content that you have in this book regarding philanthropy is really very, very significant. In this world that we're living in today, we have so much upheaval, yet people still want to be out there doing something that's going to make a difference in the world. What made you become especially interested in the area of philanthropy? Why did the two of you decide you wanted to come together to do this book to educate people?
I think the book comes out of Hal's and my experience, Hal having a even deeper experience than I do in doing philanthropy, and a sense that there is so much philanthropic money, both from individuals and foundations, that are given to nonprofits every year, and yet a lot of it doesn't seem to have as much impact as it might have. And our goal was to help philanthropists, whatever their goals are, try to use their money to achieve their goals as best possible.
And that's on all different types of levels. Strategic philanthropy. Those words, when I first read them right at the beginning of your book, I thought, this sounds more like a business how-to process of thinking than what we would usually think of. We don't realize what goes on behind a lot of these foundations. You watch programs on PBS television, and you see all these cable programs. There's a lot of grants and endowments that are given to them so that they can do what they do, plus public funding. You make a statement, and it's a sentence I will read verbatim. The basic imperative of strategic philanthropy is to deploy your resources to achieve your goals most effectively. This is good business planning. I mean, that's what I went through, but it's a little bit more than that. Give us a basic how-to. If someone listening wanted to set up a grant for a school or for something else, what are some of the strategies that they'd have to look at?
Well, let me begin by commenting on your very astute comment that this reads a lot like business strategy. I think a lot of it, strategy in some way is strategy, whether it's in business or warfare, although that's not what we're thinking of here, or philanthropy. And I think the main difference is that in business, everybody who goes into business has essentially the same goal, which is ultimately to add financial value from themselves or their company for their shareholders. Whereas philanthropy begins from the heart. It begins with every donor, whether an individual or foundation, having a passion about certain things. You mentioned schools, you know, education of disadvantaged children, perhaps, or dealing with the environment or climate. And it's so you begin with your goals, you begin with your passion, and then the question is what happens next. And I think that the essence of the book is to take practices that have been used in business for a long time, that is being clear about what your goals are, how you're going to achieve it, getting constant feedback and how you're doing, and applying those to philanthropy so that your passion, the philanthropy doesn't end with your passion, it begins there, and then you can actually try to achieve what you're passionate about.
You call the philanthropic dollars society's risk capital. And I thought, that is an interesting description. I would never have thought of it that way. Why is it risk capital?
If you let me separate non-risky and risky philanthropy. There is plenty of good philanthropy that supports charitable organizations where the risks are fairly low. If you're supporting a local food bank or homeless shelter that year after year has helped the poor, they're pretty low risk. But a lot of philanthropy is trying out programs or doing advocacy in areas where they are by no means sure to succeed. If you're supporting a new charter school organization that has a new theory about how best to help disadvantaged kids, or as Hal is doing now full time, if you are supporting work to try to reduce climate change, there's a good chance that you won't succeed. But there's the reason for philanthropy doing it is that if you do succeed, it can have tremendous impact on the lives of individuals, or in the case of climate change, on all of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And there are very few other parts of society that are willing or able to take risks like that. Politicians tend not to because they have to be reelected in a couple of years, and if the risk doesn't work, doesn't turn out right, then they're going to be thrown out of office. And philanthropy has sort of the ability to take risks that other people in society can't, and therefore I think a responsibility.
You have a number of terms that are new to me, but let's take what you're talking about just a little bit further, because you say that when you're doing this, once you decide you want to do something, I've known of individuals that maybe were left in a state and they just thought, wow, this is my opportunity. Maybe I have $500,000 here. I would just love to be able to give it or do something for the white bunny rabbits of the world that are no longer going to be around. And I know that's a ridiculous example, but I'm just tossing it out there. So they say, this is what I want to do. Well, they'll find a lot of people standing in line with their hands out saying, here, give it to me. I'll take it. But if they really want to see something work, there is a lot of thoughtfulness that needs to go in. Because you give a story about RWJF. This was a group that decided that they were going to be involved with, you know, in certain areas of projects with communities. And what they found, what undermined, they did their research afterwards, which I thought was very good. They found what undermined them is that there was distrust and competition for funding among the organizations and agencies that they gave money to, and they didn't reach their goal. This was a failure, but yet they learned from their failure. So there's a lot of fine points that you bring out in your book that I think educate an individual, that it can really make a difference, where if they want to see something, let's say for a school, like one lady I know of, had managed to save $100,000, and this was not a wealthy woman. And she ended up delegating a scholarship every year this was something she wanted done, and there were some people that helped her do this. This is a form of philanthropy.
Absolutely.
And she set things up, so this scholarship would go out, I think it was to as many as 2 or 3 students every year. But there were qualifications for that scholarship, and the students had to meet them. There's all of these different stories that you include in here, and I think they're so good to read about and to think through, because if you can, you want something to succeed, but there can be a lot of factors that can create that environment for success.
You know, I think the two examples you give are good examples of relatively non-risky and risky investments. So the scholarship, if the person is qualified and you support them going to school, then of course, I mean, there's always a risk that somebody's not going to do as well as you hope. But, you know, there you know, you can kind of trace mm-hmm. what the results of your philanthropy are. You can meet the person and see how she or he does. And then the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's program, which was trying to help a community, help a number of communities deal with serious drug and youth violence problems, you know, that you're never assured that that's going to succeed. I think they thought very hard about their planning ahead of time, and even then, as you mentioned, there were things they didn't think about that caused it not to succeed. One reason that we highlighted in the book is that they, after the program, as you say, they analyzed it, and then they published the results. They said, here's what we tried to do. We didn't succeed. Here's why. And what that's going to do is help somebody else who wants to do a similar program learn from their experience.
Mm-hmm. You had one story in here that I thought was just fascinating, and it was a group, I'm looking at it right now, the Rockefeller and Ford Foundations, that really wanted to work with family planning. Now, today that's a real hot topic. We have over 6 billion people on this planet. There's so many countries in the world that are having explosions of population. Where are we going to get the food? What are we going to do? How are we going to take care of them? And these two foundations, who have many, many talented people working for them, abandoned the issue that had been brought forward in the 1994 UN International Conference on Population and Development. But they did something that I thought was so intelligent. Instead of trying to say, you can't have babies, you can't have babies, this type of thing, they went about a whole different agenda. They shifted, and they went towards educating women, empowering women. And my thought was, somebody really caught on, because if you have women that are educated and understanding, the likelihood of them having 5, 10, 15, 12 children, you know, 15 kids, they're not going to do it.
Right. I mean, I should say that foundations that are concerned with the set of issues about both women's empowerment and the consequences of large population growth not only educate people, but they also continue to support family planning. Because
mm-hmm.
no matter how, if you're educated, the chances are that you will want to have smaller families, and that you will also start marriage at an older age and start bearing children at an older age. But even then, you need to have the methods of birth control available to you.
Mm-hmm.
So those go hand in hand. But I think you're right. This is also an example of where philanthropy has learned from social science. I think that the idea that educating women, you know, that it makes a significant difference in their lives in all sorts of ways, including how many children they have, is something that it's taken social scientists a number of decades to actually have the data to figure it out. And now the data is very strong, as you say.
Mm-hmm. It's very strong. You also bring up a combination of words, hybrid philanthropy. And I thought, this is exciting. This is wonderful, because it's just an openness. And there is the party with eBay and also with Google. How did you obtain all of this information on this hybrid philanthropy? And for my listeners, what is it?
So So what Hal and I mean by hybrid philanthropy is philanthropy that also that involves business investments at the same time. And you know, there are many business investments that, even though they're for good things like green technology, are simply you're simply participating in the market and getting market returns. Some of the explorations in hybrid philanthropy are using market devices to pursue social ends as well. So an example would be that Google is investing in some pretty far-out technologies that could reduce energy, for example, high-altitude windmills, in effect.
Mm-hmm.
And no venture capitalist, probably, certainly not in today's market, would be likely to invest in that because the likelihood of return is so low. It's really speculative. And what Google is doing is it's putting its philanthropic resources into that in the hope that by investing in something that will, if successful, will ultimately be a business, will actually have transformative effects, in this case, in terms of climate change. And it's a new model. I think that information was a lot harder to get than other information in the book. Not that anybody's keeping it secret, but it's just not as well established as the more traditional just giving money to nonprofit organizations is.
You talk about mezzanine financing in venture philanthropy. Is that related to the hybrid philanthropy?
I think it's different. What venture philanthropy, a lot of people have their own definitions of it, and what we try to do in the book is capture what we think is the most common definition as this new field is emerging, which is focusing primarily on nonprofit organizations, but helping them grow. So a terrific example in New York is the Harlem's Children's Zone, which started out as a very small after-school program for disadvantaged kids. And through funders who just wanted to help the organization multiply the number of kids it could serve, funded it the same way a venture capitalist might fund a startup, but then, and here's where the mezzanine financing comes in, the startup proves the concept, but then you need a way of expanding it.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of mezzanine financing taken from venture capital is to come in and now help the organization grow to the next phase. And it's interesting that even philanthropists who care a great deal about, say, youth services or education, there has not been a great tradition of taking an idea that somebody else started and then supporting it. A lot of philanthropists kind of want to do it themselves from scratch. And I think the whole idea of taking an existing organization and scaling it up in this way is just fabulous, and it's shown to have important results.
You have brought out so much information about various people. Warren Buffett gave a huge amount of money to the Gates Foundation. This organization has just been just amazing because they have been able, they've supplied computers, they've empowered libraries. They have just done so many things. It's just been amazing. But Warren Buffett wanted to have this massive amount of money working, but there was an expectation that this money was to be all utilized within 50 years. Am I correct in what I read?
I think that's right. I don't remember the exact terms, but I think that Bill and Melinda Gates themselves want the foundation to end some years after they pass away. And I think Warren Buffett, has, as part of his gift, required that his money be spent pretty much on as it comes in and as it earns additional income. It's a very smart decision on his part, I think, because he's somebody who said, I'm really good at making money, but I don't have the knowledge to give it away. And he had confidence, as he well should have, in Bill and Melinda Gates, and said, "I'm gonna give this to somebody else who I know has a track record in making a difference throughout the world."
And they're accountable. They have open books, so to speak. They're not afraid of talking about things. That's one of the things that has caused a dilemma in thinking on people's minds so frequently. They go, well, is my money really going for the right things? There have been so many abuses that often have been brought out. And, of course, there's so many organizations that are out there that are doing a very good job, and a lot of them don't have a great deal of money, that are responsible and are accountable. And what would you say to someone if they had a legacy of some kind that they wanted to pass on? Or, you know, where would they go to check these things out? How do they know who to go to? I mean, Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, that's totally understandable. But what about some other people that might be listening to the show? If they had something they wanted to give to someone, how do you go about making sure that the group or the organization you want to work with or be a part of, or maybe somebody wants to start one? What do you do?
Right. So one thing you can do is if you're interested in a particular area, and of course philanthropy covers just an amazingly wide range of topics, if there's an organization that has a good and long track record and you've read their literature, and even better, you have met some of their personnel, but for many people just reading it and having great confidence, then one possibility is give directly to the organization. Another thing to do is what Mr. Buffett did, which is if there's a foundation that you respect that's working in your area. So in the Gates Foundation, for example, its work in health and vaccines is just extraordinary. Or, you know, you find a foundation that's been there for a long time, the Ford Foundation, Packard, Hewlett, which is working in an area that is your passion, then there are two possibilities. One is you might give to the foundation, although I'm not sure that all foundations are set up to take money. Or you can follow their example. You can say, because every foundation publishes who it makes grants to on their website.
Mm-hmm.
And so you say, okay, I'm going to follow. You know, I think that the work that this foundation is doing in Western conservation is excellent. Let me see who they make grants to, and I'll make grants to the same organization.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about grants for a moment. They are a very significant part of philanthropy. What if someone had a project that they said, gee whiz, I would love to know where I could go for grants? How do you go? I mean, there's a real skill in being a grant writer. There are people that's how they make their living, is writing grants.
That's true.
Because it is a very specialized area. How do you go about doing that?
The first thing you need to do is find out what foundations will support what the work that your organization is doing. And there is a nonprofit organization which has existed for some time called the Foundation Center, and they have a website. And I think you need to pay a fee if you want to dig down very deep, but for a reasonable fee, you can go on their website and learn about foundations that are interested in the subject of your particular organization.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever it is, you can learn about it. And then is the question of contacting the organization, and whatever, usually most foundations have their application procedures on their own website, and you can find out whether they're making grants in your area, and if they are, how to apply.
Mm-hmm.
I think that for the most part, most smaller organizations can at least go that far without hiring a outside grant writer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only if it looks like there's going to be some possibility of the foundation making a grant that you might want professional assistance.
Very good advice. Now, there are all kinds of, like I said, all types of subject matter. You go into grant funding. You talk about so many things, providing goods and services. You say there's organizational effectiveness grants, capacity building management assistance grants. I mean, they range from anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000. There are so many options out there. It is a much bigger reality than I ever imagined.
You know, I'm not great with large numbers without looking at them, but the nonprofit sector accounts for a very large part of the economy, obviously not as big as business,
mm-hmm.
and but a huge part of the economy. So it's not surprising that there would be so many different kinds of organizations and so many different ways of supporting them. I mean, it's an amazing field. I've only been in it for 10 years. Maybe that shouldn't be prefaced with only. And I continue to marvel at the diversity of the work being done in the nonprofit sector.
You cover so much of that. You talk about the responsibilities of philanthropy. You talk about making plans if you wanted to have a legacy where maybe it would go on for a long, long, long time, or it would be ad infinitum. You talk about doing like Buffett did, where you make it short term. There's so much that you present in your book, Money Well Spent, A Strategic Plan for Smart Philanthropy. When you put this book together, when you were in the process of doing this, you and Hal Harvey, what did you find was your greatest challenge in bringing this information together into this comprehensive format?
I think our greatest challenge, and you can tell me whether you think we succeeded at it, is to take the technical expertise we have as insiders doing philanthropy with a large foundation and translate it into language that somebody who didn't work at a large foundation could understand, so that a reader who picked it up in a bookstore, who was interested in his or her own philanthropy but was not a professional, could translate into something that would be useful to them. And I think we worked hard on that. And you can, as I say, you can tell us whether we succeeded.
Well, I would say you did succeed. It is something that really mentally puts you into a whole different paradigm from what, as an individual that's never given a lot of thought to foundations other than seeing little blurbs that come up on the television screen, or you'll hear about this group or that group. Most of us don't have the time, and to be frank, we may not even have the interest unless there's something on our personal level of involvement in life that maybe makes us aware of this. But it just was so expansive. When the two of you finished this, what was it that you learned that you didn't know before?
Oh, that's interesting. We learned so much because even working at a large foundation, every foundation does things in their own way. But let me think about what particular take home lessons there were. I mean, one thing we learned, which was fun, was the joy of collaborating with somebody who is like minded, but who thinks about things somewhat differently the way you do. And you know, collaborations in writing sometimes can be very frustrating. In our case, it was very successful. But you're asking really what we learned substantively. And I think what it did was reinforce both of our senses that if with just a little bit of strategy, in the sense of being clear, if people are clear about their goals, and if people get feedback on how they're doing with respect to their goals, if they ask the organizations they're funding, how are you doing in accomplishing what you said you would do, that a dollar, a philanthropic dollar, can go much further than it does for most people. The power, that is, of taking an existing amount of money, and of course these days many, many charitably inclined people have less money than they had a year ago, and making it go further,
mm-hmm.
is, I think, the real power of strategic philanthropy. And I think we learned that in the process of researching and writing the book.
Paul Brest is my guest. He is the president of the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. This book, if you're interested in grants, if you're interested in philanthropy, foundations, there's a lot of subject matter in this book, very, very well organized, very easily understood, well presented. The book is Money Well Spent, A Strategic Plan for Smart Philanthropy, something we all are involved with on our own in many, many different ways and many different levels. Mr. Bress, thank you so much for being my guest today. I so enjoyed your material, and I just think you have done us all a tremendous service because it's an education. It really is, to go through the material you have presented today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break. We'll be back in just a bit. Don't go away. Lots of good things to share. We'll be right back.
This is Pete Smith for OrthoTeb Health Shoes. OrthoTebs are completely heelless, invented by a doctor, and you'll burn 3 times the calories of regular walking in our sandals, 2 times the calories of regular walking in our clogs. They help you tone and trim the entire leg, thighs, buns, lower abs, and love handle area. They offer symptom improvement for people with plantar fasciitis and low back pain. Check them out on the web at www.orthoteb.net.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, ttap.com.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Telephone lines are now open if you'd like to give me a call. Hey, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. I'm an information resource, and I am available. 877-876-5227 is the toll-free number, 877-876-5227. We have a worldwide number of 888-815-9756, no matter where you're located, including the U.S., you can call 888-815-9756. I had someone that ended up calling later in the show yesterday, and they just need to remember that if it's not an open mic day, always during the second half of the show, those telephone lines are open. So I just wanted to let you know. And all I need from you is your first name or your initial, and then after that, just let me tell you what I perceive, and you're welcome then when I finish to ask a question about anything that you like. Well, I wanted to share a couple of points of information that I was sent. One bit of information was sent to me by a woman named Marguerite. She said, have you ever heard the story about Kinko's? And I thought, after I read it, hey, this is entrepreneurship at its best. You know, there's over 1,500 of Kinko's facilities worldwide. But the person that started the business was labeled, actually, they described themselves this way, as a hyperactive dyslexic who failed second and ninth grade in school. Now, Paul Orfalia is the gentleman that founded Kinko's. He went on to graduate school, and he graduated from the University of Southern California. Now, as a student, he was observing. There was a copy machine in the library. And at the time when he was in college, he said very few people had easy access to the new technology. My goodness, we take it all for granted now, our scanners and all this other good stuff. But in 1970, he followed his desire to make technology available to people and borrowed $5,000 and opened the first Kinko's near the USC campus. Now, the 100-square-foot space was in the back of a hamburger stand. The place was so small and so cramped, the copy machine had to be lugged out on the sidewalk each day. Only in California could you do this. But that's what he did. The company's name, Kinko, that was Paul's nickname. And his college friends gave him that nickname of Kinko because of his curly, curly hair that was just wild and crazy. Now, he had the strategy that so many entrepreneurs do, and that is see a need and fill it. He was selling copies and school supplies to fellow students and was so successful that by the close of the 1970s, Kinko's had 80 stores located primarily near colleges and universities. Very, very practical, wouldn't you think? Now, by the end of the 1980s, the company had expanded to service the small office home market with nearly over 400 stores. And in the late 1990s, and, of course, the early part of the 21st century, the Kinko's business made Fortune magazine's list of the 100 best companies to work for in America, also Forbes' list of the 500 biggest private companies, and another magazine, Working Mother magazine's list of best companies for working moms. Well, in 2004, the FedEx Corporation acquired Kinko's, and today Paul is involved in a variety of different business ventures. He teaches, he does a lot of speaking, and he's very much involved in philanthropic activities because he wants kids of today that are facing the learning challenges that he faced himself to have better opportunities than he did at the time. But I like the story, and I want to thank Marguerite for sending it, because what it does, it shows you that you can take adversity and you can make adversity work for you in its own way. There are many, many people that maybe will never ever have a Kinko's business worth, you know, billions of dollars, but the fact is, we need entrepreneurs of all kinds of levels. The backbone of this nation comes from the middle class, from those entrepreneurs, those small businesses that are out there servicing the needs of all of us on so many different levels. But it takes a willingness to take risk. And just like we were talking about philanthropic activities earlier in the show, when you're in business and you're in business for yourself, the same basic principles can apply on all levels of whatever it is you want to do. You can take obstacles that may be working against you and have them work for you. It is something that when you have adversities, you may just have to think a little bit differently. That's what Kinko did. He thought differently, built a business with his nickname that is known around the world. We even have one in our neck of the woods out here in the Pacific Northwest. Actually, we have quite a number of them. And they're wonderful, and they've adapted to the needs of the marketplace as they have changed, because a lot of people in their small offices have been able to take care of a lot of things that before printers took care of. I know of a printing company that actually went out of business because people didn't need the services that they had before, because they now had computers and they had color printers and all kinds of things that were doing in an economic way what they used to have to go to the printers for. But that's all right. You shift and you change, but it doesn't mean that you can't adapt to the needs of the environment that you're in. So I just wanted to share that story with you today. This is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of insight. 877-876-5227 is the telephone number, 877-876-5227. Also, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. That's a worldwide number. Now, I do want to let those of you know that are listening in Alaska, and I know we've got a caller on the line, but those of you up in Alaska, I'm going to be traveling up to Alaska on the 9th of March, and I'll be up there for a week, so I'll be giving you more details as we get closer to that time frame. Also, I've got a class coming up on the 25th of April in Tacoma, Washington, so those of you in the western area of Washington, we'll be giving you more information on that as we get closer to that date as well. Let's go to our first caller of the day. Welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
Yes, Casey, and I'm calling from Atlanta, Georgia.
Atlanta, oh, one of my favorite cities. Wow, it's such a beautiful place.
Yes, it is.
Well, thanks for calling in. Casey, the first thing that I'm looking at with you is business, actually. You are on the fence about two decisions that you must make, and you don't quite have enough facts to give you what you feel is your edge to make your choice. Well, keep asking the questions, and I'm seeing within the cycle of two. I don't know if it's 2 days or 2 weeks or 2 months, but it's a short period. You're going to have all the facts you need, but you've got to persist, because if you don't ask the questions, nobody's going to volunteer the information. And once you get those questions asked, do some brainstorming with two people that you're very close with that are really, really savvy. And say, all right, this is the information I've got. If you were me, what else would you want to know?
Okay.
And let them give you their perspectives. Give them the facts as you have them and say, this is what I'm looking at. This is what I'm evaluating. You probably will be asked by both of these people. Each of them are very independent in their thinking and very different in their experiences. And this is good because you want to get their perspectives. You want to say, this is what I have in the way of information. This is what I want. This is what I wish to see as a result. If you were in my situation, what questions would you ask? Don't ask them to give you answers.
Okay.
Ask them what questions would they ask. Then go and ask the questions they ask. Make a note of the information, then go back to them again. Because these are two people that have tremendous integrity. And they'll just love to help you out. So go for it. You have nothing to lose and everything to gain.
Oh, thanks.
What's on your mind, dear? What did you want to ask me?
Yes, actually, I was looking at that. I know that when I had been looking at many different decisions with business and I had looked at relationships, those were both it, or the two that you kept seeing.
Did you have a specific question for me?
Oh, no, you just answered it, actually. That's what I had been wondering about.
Well, I'm so glad. Well, you know, sometimes knowing how to ask the right questions or knowing the questions to ask, I should say it both ways, really can assist.
Thank you.
You are very welcome. How'd you hear about the show?
Actually, I had seen Ron, one of the people who were on a different one, had brought up the BBS radio, and then I heard about contacting you guys through bdsradio.com, and I listen to it, and I love the show that you have.
Oh, thank you. Well, you'll be sure to pass along the information to your friends so they can call in, too.
Oh, I will. Thank you so much.
You are very welcome, Casey. You have a wonderful evening now.
You too.
This is Donna Sebo. You can do just like Casey just did. Give me a buzz if you want to chat, 877-876-5227. And also worldwide, including the U.S., 888-815-9756. I had someone ask me if I do private readings. Yes, I do. I'm available privately. All you have to do is give me a call at my office, 800-872-8852. I'll be glad to give you the details regarding that. But also, you can go to my website, and you can look up information. That's a good place to go always. That's Donna. That's DelphiInternational.com, excuse me, D-E-L-P-H-I, and then the whole word, international, the two I's are back to back, And you can also send me an email, Donna@DelphiInternational.com. Now, I have to tell you, I don't answer questions via email. It's either online with a show, or you can call me for a private appointment. Let's go to our next caller today. Welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
Palm Gear, Indiana.
I'm sorry, sir. I can barely hear you. Your voice is soft. Your name again, please. Hello? Well, I think we must have lost the caller. I knew he was calling from Louisiana, but I could not hear him. Well, that's all right, caller. You can call right back if you so desire. Also, I wanted to, with time permitting, and I know we're just about ready to go on break, I wanted to give you some suggestions. There are so, regarding money, there are so many people that are so frightened, and I know so many have lost money due to stocks and investments, et cetera, that have gone awry. But remember, using good sense can go a long way. And I'll maybe share a little bit of some suggestions that I think. Oh, there we go. Here we go. Hello, caller.
Well, hello, Donna. I am very glad to talk with you.
And what's your first name or initial, dear?
L.
And where are you calling from?
Bellingham.
Bellingham, Washington?
Yes.
All right. Now, we're going to be going on break. Will you stay on the line with me, dear?
I sure will.
All right. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break for a moment. When we come back, we'll be talking with Elle in Bellingham, and if we have time, we'll talk with you, too. This is Donna Sebo. We'll be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Enter the magical world of God's Kiss.
Johnny finds himself at the entrance to a large open valley, framed by high mountains rich in the brown-red colors of the earth. He stands in awe, even a little fearful of the mountain's great size. After all, he's just a little boy and not very tall.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling, and the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.DelphiInternational.com. That 800 number again, 872-8852.
Pete Smith here with OrthoTab Health Shoes. These funky-looking shoes, invented by a medical doctor, will make you feel better. Who has time to work out these days? Wear our sandals or clogs around the house, go shopping, wear them on the treadmill. You'll burn extra calories, you'll tone and trim the legs, thighs, lower abdomen, rear end, your love handle area. You'll simply feel better. Check them out on the web at orthotebb.net.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Before we go to Elle in Bellingham, Washington, here are the telephone numbers you can call in to: 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. Yes, Elle, are you still with me?
Yes, I am.
All right. Now, the first thing I'm looking at with you is a sense of sadness. When I'm observing you in my mind, you apparently are really beating up on yourself with a level of criticism that I think is totally unnecessary, that you need to be practical and you need to look at how perhaps you are not or have not done certain things to maybe the best of your capability. That doesn't mean you cannot make adjustments and move forward. Don't stay stuck in what you think is not working. You can unstick yourself, if that sounds appropriate. You can move on very quickly. You don't have to be just absolutely burdened with this self-criticism. It's a waste of time. Utilize what you can in the way of the experiences you've gone through, and then dump what isn't working and get a move in, because this is a very dynamic year for you, especially after the 15th of March. So it is good for you to prepare yourself. It is good for you to take care of whatever you need to take care of, even if it's tedious and boring. That's all right. Get what you want behind you. Don't be afraid of any shadows. Just move forward. Do everything you can to get things in neat and tidy and in order, and you're going to find that starting after the 15th of March, the pace of moving forward is going to be a lot better for you. What question would you like to ask me today?
Well, that is really good advice, and thank you. And I am just wondering, do you see a new relationship coming to me who can help me create a sustainable land project as I've done before with my late husband?
Okay, I couldn't hear all of what you said. Your voice is soft.
Oh,
what is this about
that.
Your late husband?
Yeah, do you see a new relationship coming to me who can help me create a sustainable land project as I've done before?
Well, I think that there is going, let me go two levels here. When it comes to a person in your life that will be a partner, there is going to be that special person. I'm looking at the number five. I don't know if it's the fifth month of the year, like May, that you will meet this person, or if it's going to be within 5 years. But the number five is very strongly associated with a person that I believe is going to become a life partner. And this is going to be an association that I think will grow slowly. It is not going to be hot and heavy and fast and bingo, we get married and that's it. Neither one of you will be of that disposition, and so you will be thoughtful. I think that the partner is going to also be someone that's involved in business, which will be very good for you. Now, if I heard you correctly, there was something about an association regarding a land investment. Is that true?
Yes, I'm just needing someone to do it with me, and I'm wondering if the relationship will come before the purchase of property or if the property would come first.
Well, I would like for you not to worry about having someone involved in this property situation.
Okay.
I don't think you need to go there. I think what you need to do is look at exactly what is going on now. If you are wanting to invest in some property, you need to evaluate it and ask yourself, do you want this as a short-term investment or a long-term investment?
It would be long-term.
All right. If it's long-term, were you thinking of getting acreage?
Yes, and leave it as a legacy, a teaching platform for the future students. And
all right. If you're looking at this, boy, you need this book, Money Well Spent, that I just did the interview
yes,
on.
Yes, I just
today.
Heard that.
Oh, this would be just such a wonderful book for you to review.
Yes.
But if you're looking at the acreage, you need to think and perhaps consult with someone about how you want to set it up, because you should not lock it into a legacy package until you're really ready to do that.
Okay.
You need to be able to look at making the investment in the property. And the reason I say this, let's say you had an opportunity to buy 80 acres. I'll just use that as a number, mm-hmm. toss it out. You had this 80 acres, and maybe you were going to be able to get it for such an excellent price because part of it had floodplain in it. So, and again, this is just a make-believe example. So you say, okay, this is such a good opportunity. I really want to do this. In the course of having that property and being able to set it up maybe with a 40-year payoff plan.
Oh, I'd just pay it off.
Yes, you would pay it off. But maybe you would do it incrementally because it would help you in some way, shape, or form.
Well, I don't believe in being extended. I like just having things paid for if possible.
Well, I understand that, hon. I'm just giving you a hypothetical situation.
Okay.
So while you're doing this and you're looking at it and you're seeing all of this stuff that's going on, then all of a sudden maybe some circumstances change and maybe you find that there is a preserve that you would like to have in this floodplain area. And maybe someone gives you some insights in what you could do. So maybe you start out with one plan and you find that the plan actually expands. So you want to be sure that you are open, that you don't try to have what I call a steel trap attitude about what is or what is not going to be done.
Right. Leave it flexible. And my intuition was telling me that already.
Yes. Leave it flexible. Allow it to show you, as you evolve with it, what it is that you want to do. If you pay this off in 10 years, that's wonderful. However it goes. But be open to the possibilities because it really will make a difference.
Yes, I can see that in my mind's eye.
Well, Elle, thank you for your call, hon. I'm out of time.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the input.
Oh, you're more than welcome. It was a pleasure to have you as a guest on the show. And just keep on doing.
Keep on trucking.
Yes, ma'am. That's what you need to do.
All right.
Take care. This is Donna Sebo. My goodness, we're out of time. Hey, we've got a great guest. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about sound therapy techniques and technology. David Gibson, who is a BBS radio host, is going to be with us. We're going to be talking about all kinds of therapies regarding sound. I know you'll find it interesting. I know I did. This is Donna Sebo. Remember, always you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Invest in yourself, and I'll tell you what, you will have so much that you'll be able to share with others that your good will be pressed down and overflowing in magnificent ways. This is Donna. We'll talk with you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here at bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.